talking about yesterday. The difference between a yogi and a yani and so forth and so on.
Swami.
And when you left, I opened the magazine Mary left with me. And I came across an article by Shirdi Sai Baba, which was talking about the exact same thing. So would you like to read this, Mary? We'll get a different perspective, a different point of view.
Do you want me to sit there and read it?
Yes, obviously not.
Oh. Okay, that's fine. I can sit there. That's okay, I can sit right there. This is great. No hassle. Okay, the incredible Sai Baba. Can you hear me from down here?
Sure.
Okay. Sai Baba never wrote a book. His behavior was bizarre, and he flaunted his miracles with the reckless exuberance of a child.
Is this Shirdi Sai Baba?
Shirdi.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. This was written by Arthur Osborne. No easy saint to introduce to the modern reader. Not only did he not write books, he did not read them either. He did occasionally instruct a devotee to read some religious or scriptural work, but for the most part, he discouraged them from reading. People hope to find Brahma in these books, but it is Brahma, confusion, not Brahma, God, that they find there. There is nothing unorthodox in such a statement. Some basic theoretical understanding is necessary, except in very rare cases. But continued accumulation of theoretical knowledge does not help towards spiritual understanding. Indeed, mental study can distract a man from the more arduous task of spiritual effort with the false allure of an easy alternative, particularly in this age when such floods of books are churned out. Is it a danger? Sri Ramakrishna also neither practiced nor enjoined scholarship. Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi, though enormously erudite, wrote in a derogatory way of book learning. It is the unlearned who are saved rather than those whose ego has not subsided despite their learning. The unlearned are saved from the unrelenting grip of self-infatuation, from the malady of myriad whirling thoughts, from the endless pursuit of mental wealth. It is not from one ill alone that they are saved. The unlearned state described here means, of course, not mere ignorance, but the simplicity and integrity of mind which Taoism extols, which Christ designated as like a little child, which Islam implies in the illiteracy of the prophet. It is not incompatible with learning. Nevertheless, learning cannot produce it, and absorption in learning can destroy it. For years it was doubted whether Sai Baba was even literate. Certainly nobody supposed that he knew Sanskrit. Then one day he gave an exposition which showed learning as well as the perspicacity and rough humor natural to him. A devotee was massaging his legs and feet, chanting to himself, the while in an undertone. Sai Baba asked him what he was muttering. A Sanskrit verse, he replied, not suspecting that Sai Baba knew enough of scripture to want a more precise answer. However, he asked, what verse? A verse from the Gita. Well, say it aloud. And the devotee then recited in Sanskrit verse 34 of chapter 4. Know that by means of prostration, inquiry, and service, the yanis, the enlightened, who have realized the truth will teach you jnana, knowledge. Do you understand this, Nana? Baba asked him. Yes. Then tell me the meaning. Nana gave a free rendering in the vernacular, but Sai Baba was not satisfied. I don't want a paraphrase. I want the strict grammatical meaning with case, mood, and tense. Nana gave a literal translation, wondering the while whether Baba knew anything of Sanskrit grammar. He soon found out. And Tat Vidi? What does Tat stand for? Baba asked him. Jnana, knowledge. What knowledge? Knowledge of what? The knowledge referred to in the previous stanza. What does pranapat mean? Prostration. And pat? The same. If they meant the same, would vayasa have added two unnecessary syllables? I don't see any difference between them, Nana admitted. Baba left that for a while and passed on to the next point. What does prasna mean? Asking questions. And para prasna, the same. Then if they both mean the same, was Vyasa off his head to use the longer?
Vyasa is the author of the Mahabharata.
I don't see any difference. Next point. What does seva mean? Service, such as I am doing now in massaging your feet. Nothing more? I don't see what more it can mean. We'll leave that too. Next point. Krishna tells Arjuna to get jnana, knowledge, from jnanis, the enlightened. But wasn't Krishna himself a jnani? Yes. Then why does he send Arjuna to others instead of giving him jnana himself? I don't know. Wasn't Arjuna a jiva, a being, and therefore an emanation of Chaitanya, universal consciousness? Yes. Then how can knowledge be given to what is already an emanation of consciousness or knowledge? Sai Baba then interpreted the verse to mean that it is not jnana, knowledge, but ajnana, non-knowledge or ignorance, that the guru gives. Nana, now thoroughly bewildered over what had seemed to him a straightforward verse, asked Sai Baba to expound these points. He explained, the verse tells us how a disciple is to approach his guru in order to attain realization. He must completely surrender body, mind, soul, and possessions to the guru. That is the prostration referred to. The inquiry must be a constant quest for truth, not questions asked out of mere curiosity or for a wrong motive, such as to trap the guru. The motive must be pure desire for spiritual progress and realization. Then the service is not mere physical service, such as massaging. For it to be effective, there must be no idea that you are free to give or withhold service. You must feel that your body no longer belongs to you, since you have surrendered it to the guru, and it exists only to do him service. Then followed a catechism on the guru giving ignorance. Isn't Brahma pure knowledge or being? Yes. And everything else non-being or ignorance, non-knowledge? Yes. Don't the scriptures declare that Brahma is beyond the range of speech or mind? Yes. Then the speech of the guru is not Brahma or knowledge? No. Then you admit that what the guru says is not knowledge, but ignorance. It seems so. Then the guru's instruction is simply a piece of ignorance used to remove the disciple's ignorance. Just as we use a thorn to remove another thorn from the foot, isn't it? I suppose so. The disciple is a jiva, a being, whose essential nature is knowledge, isn't he? Yes. Then there is obviously no need to give him knowledge, but simply to remove the veil of ignorance that hides the existent knowledge. This, of course, is not to be done at one stroke, since the disciple is immersed in age-old ignorance and needs repeated instructions, perhaps through life after life. And what is the nature of this instruction through speech about what is beyond speech? Isn't it like removing a cover? Ignorance conceals the pre-existent knowledge, just as water plants cover over the surface of a pond. Clear away the plants, and you have the water. You don't have to create it. It is there already. Or take another example. A cataract grows on the eye and prevents a man from seeing. Remove the cataract and he sees. Ignorance is the cataract. The universe is the efflorescence of the indescribable Maya, which is ignorance. Yet ignorance is needed to illuminate and dissolve this ignorance. Divine knowledge is to be realized, not taught. Prostration, inquiry, and service are the methods by which to obtain the grace of the Guru. It is an illusion to suppose that phenomena are real. That is the screen of ignorance which hides knowledge. Tear it off, and Brahma or knowledge will shine forth. Ignorance is the seed of samsara, birth and death. Put the medicine of the Guru's grace on the eye, and the screen of Maya lifts, leaving only jnana, knowledge. Jnana is not something to be attained. It is eternal and self-existent. On the other hand, ignorance has a cause and an end. The root of it is the idea that the devotee is a separate being from God. Remove this, and what remains is jnana. Now the question why Krishna referred Arjuna to other gurus instead of giving him jnana himself. Did Krishna consider other jnanis separate from himself, or their teaching different from his? No. So their teaching is his, and there is no difference.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Robert.
Now let's talk about you. Your real nature is knowledge. You know that. If your real nature is knowledge, what do you expect to find in books?
That's a book, and I just pointed out that you can't find anything in books.
That book is a finger. It's a finger pointing towards the goal.
Okay, but well, you cannot destroy all books.
We don't want to destroy all books. We want to realize that many people waste their lifetime in books. One after the other. It's like a drug habit. Once you get involved in books, you can't stop. And you read book after book after book.
Then not even, why read this to us?
To tell you what I'm telling you.
I mean, but we might get stuck in it. We might be drunk.
Well, I'm explaining, that's why I'm explaining it to you. That's why I'm talking and I'm explaining it to you. Just like my words are ignorance, right? The words are ignorance. Because words cannot tell you the truth. They can lead you to the truth.
Right. Can I read something here? We did another transcription of Robert's tapes, and it was called The Fourth State of Consciousness. And Robert always asked me to put a little introduction to it. And I just want to read that introduction, if I may, please.
Sure.
we sit at the feet of the awakened one. He fills our hearts with his overflowing love. Even if we are a little receptive, we come away charged by his very presence. Receptivity helps break the barriers that block the flow of the all-pervading current of love. What he gives, we already are. I just wrote this morning before we came. There is no search to be made. There are no books to read. Soon the world begins to fade, and we find there is nothing we need.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Look at all the talent Mary has.
No. See, I'm just... For that.
My goodness, we always find something else. Some great talent in areas. But that's true. Try to understand.
Hmm?
What?
We're free to read books that we want to
read. You're free to do anything you like.
Right.
You can do anything you want to do.
You don't have to get fixated on nothing. That's a fixation. It's like when you...
Who's talking about being fixated on nothing?
Well, when you say no... no need to read at all. If you feel like reading, read.
I'm saying there has to come a time in our lives when we realize the reading and the external searching is virtually sort of useless.
The end of search.
Yes. There is a time years before when we read books and we got involved in external means. But now we've come here. And we have grown. Therefore, I can tell you plainly and surely, books are not the answer. Anything external is not the answer. My external body for you is not the answer. The answer is within you. You are the answer. You are the beginning and the end. You are the wisdom. You are the solution. Turn within. Find the knowledge that you are. And even to say find it is a misnomer, for there's nothing to find. You simply have to awaken. And again, that's a word. Who has to awaken? The ego, right? But the ego doesn't exist. So there's no one to awaken. Awaken from what? Awaken from the sleep. From ayani, from ignorance. But who is in ignorance? The mind, the ego. But the mind and the ego do not exist. So how can you be in ignorance? There is no ignorance. And there is no one to awaken. There is no battle to win. Many people like to believe they're fighting a battle within themselves. And they tell me, Robert, I'm fighting the battle of the Bhagavad Gita within me. The Bhagavad Gita. All kinds of turmoil is going on in my mind. Whose mind? My mind. How do you know you've got a mind? Who told you this? No answer. There's no mind. There's no ignorance, there's no battle. There's absolutely nothing you have to do except to open your eyes and see. That's what he means in that article. A guru can only teach you ignorance. Four words and not the answer. Silence is the answer. Yet in silence, the mind starts to move and brings up all kinds of concepts, preconceived ideas. you can't control it sometimes. Then you have to learn to observe it. And you watch your thoughts. You see your mind, the way it vacillates. When you do that for a while, you ask yourself, who sees the mind? And the observer has to go. Then you ask yourself, who is getting rid of the observer? No answer. There is no one left to get rid of the observer. There is no observer watching your thoughts. There are no thoughts, and there is no mind. You are totally free now. But you don't believe me.
I believe
you. No, you don't.
No.
You won't believe me. Something says I want to. But the first thing that comes along, your interest will perk up toward it. And you'll go chasing it. So you believe me to an extent as long as you're in this room. But when the world gets a hold of you, say you come home and you find your house burned down, what do you believe then? Then you'll say, if Robert was right, my house wouldn't have burned down. What does your house have to do with the teaching? You are not your body, you are not your house, and you are not the experience of burning house down. If you can be free of all that, then you can say you believe me. But as long as things still disturb you, as long as what you hear still disturbs you, you listen to the TV, you hear the radio, you hear what somebody says, talks to you on the telephone, and you may get shocked, you may get disturbed. Then how can you hear me?
What does one need to understand? What has to happen to someone to prove that in any circumstance that they don't get disturbed?
One needs to understand nothing. No thing. And be free from the whole mess.
So how does one ever tell that they're free from the whole mess?
Oh, you'll know. Because the world will be like images on the screen. They will not affect you one iota. The good or the bad are in between, so-called. The world will appear like images. And you will be forever you. Your eternal self. You will not feel turned on one time and turned off another time. You will not feel happy when something good happens to you and miserable when some human evil befalls you. You will treat those two imposters just the same. And you will be totally free.
So if that's happening in someone's life, then...
Well, just that statement is erroneous. Because there's no life for something to happen to. The life becomes extinguished. And nothing can happen. Something can happen to your life when you are an Ayani. Then you say something good happened in my life or something bad happened in my life. But when you're experiencing total freedom, there is no life to have. You have no life, so nothing can happen. You're just totally free, without any happenings.
then there's no you for it to happen to.
There's no you. You has been extinguished. Right. There's no you, there's no I. There's no object, and there's no subject.
Would the proper attitude be when you say, when you realize there is, that this doesn't exist, we don't exist, and you say, and when you realize that, then you will be free. If the student says, then free from what? Is that the attitude?
Your whole sentence is a misnomer. Because you say, when you realize that, if you realize anything, you can't possibly be free. Because the realizer is still there. You follow? As long as there's a realizer, you can't be free. The realizer goes, and there's no one to make that statement.
Yes, but what about the last statement?
Free from what? Free from... No, see, the subject that you just spoke of, free from what, is only there when you think you're a body-mind. Then you say free from what. But if you're talking about freedom like I think you are, there's no one left to say free from what. Because there would be nothing to be free from. You were never bound in the first place.
That's the reason why a person would...
Well, the person would ask, when a person asks that question, they're obviously bound, or they wouldn't ask the question.
The person who says...
Free from what? Yes. Because if the person were free, he wouldn't have that feeling to be free from anything. There would be nobody left to have that feeling.
There'd be no limitations in any direction.
Yes. So when the question is asked, it's asked by the ayani, by the person who's bound. The person who's free just smiles.
No, but if the person who's smiling wished to express something, that there was no threat,
let's take myself as an example. I share these thoughts with you, and I talk to you about these things, but to me they're utter nonsense. But I'm doing the talking because I've got a class.
Well, in the same way, couldn't there be someone else talking? Because they're in the class with you?
Anybody can talk anytime they like.
So then couldn't my, for instance, my gene is addressing
your gene?
That's your name.
Oh, gene. I thought you were Clyde.
You're wrong. Clyde, yes. I have two names. Mm-hmm. So my Clyde is addressing Robert. And on that level, saying, break him one.
And I'm telling you, who asked the question?
Buddha said free from suffering.
Who's asking the question?
Buddha said what?
Freedom from suffering.
Oh, that was in the teaching, of course. Freedom from, you can get into that if you like.
But then what suffering?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, anyway, Clyde thought that that was expressing the fact that stuff happens.
Well, Clyde is expressing where she's coming from. And that's good. Nothing wrong with that. Mm. But when you say free from what, then if I answer you at your level, I will answer like perhaps what he said, free from suffering, free from pain.
Oh, I know.
Free from this and free from that. But I would rather ask who asked the question. And if you get the drift of my meaning, it would awaken you. Because nobody exists to ask that question. Clyde doesn't exist. And Clyde is asking the question.
Never mind.
Yes, dear.
You're not ready to disappear?
There's a lot of energy to do that.
Bob, will you guys?
Yeah, I think the whole problem is that, like, the personal self is trying to get liberated, and liberation is freedom from the self.
Hmm. Of course. As long as you feel you are the personal self, you can never become liberated. Because the finite cannot comprehend the infinite. So it's a waste of time doing all of the yoga practices, meditations, and everything else. If you want to become totally liberated, it's fine to do those things if you want to have a better mind and a better body and find human so-called happiness for a while. But if you want total freedom, all that has to be given up. And we start from the top, not from the body, not from the bottom. We start exactly at the top. There is no body, there is no universe, there is no one to get enlightened, there is no God to pray to, there is no universe as you see it, and you do not exist as you know yourself. And that's it.
And no self-inquiry.
No self-inquiry. Those sound like good words. Sounds like good words. No self-inquiry.
What's the use of self-inquiry?
You inquire into the no self. Then why inquire if there's no self?
If you realize there's no self, what do you need self-inquiry for?
You don't. But do you realize there's no self?
If you realize it, you don't realize.
So you ask the question. All questions are necessary for the one who asks. Therefore, don't feel funny when you ask a question. And when I answer you, I don't mean to sort of put you down. That's not my purpose. I'm not doing that. But it's just fun to have a go about and go back and forth. My position is nothing exists. Period. And I am is that. And that's the end.
I am is that.
I am is that.
What does that stand for?
I am is being. Being is absolute awareness.
We just trade words.
That's what we're doing.
We're just jumping along on different.
That's places. Exactly what we're doing.
They all mean the same thing.
Yes. No, nothing.
What's the point of that?
No point whatsoever.
Yeah, why do you do it?
Because people want to hear me talk.
Yeah. When you answer questions, do you hear the questions that are asked of you and answer appropriately, or do you misunderstand sometimes, or do you say things to try to see if there's a reaction in that person? And then play with that?
No, I have no motive. It's all spontaneous.
You're not psyching them out, are you?
No, on the contrary.
Well, then I, if I have a question, and I'm not, it feels like there's, I'm not getting any kind of appropriate answer, so to speak. I'm speaking very loosely here.
You're a loose guy.
I don't want to get caught up. When I speak with you privately, I get a very different response from you. Whenever I speak with you publicly, it's very different than when I speak with you privately. Privately, you seem to be able to understand where I'm coming from, what I'm saying. Publicly, whenever I ask you something or make a statement or talk, it's very different. And it doesn't upset me in the least, but it's not confusing because, you know, whatever I'm experiencing or whatnot is what I'm experiencing or knowing.
I suppose what I'm doing publicly, Jay, is I'm giving you the answer for the whole class.
Yeah, but
and that's for your individual.
an individual person, and I'm talking about relative terms, on a relative level, everyone's at a different place, so to speak.
Mm.
And is it, I enjoy coming here just because I just come here, I'm always here. I don't think I'm going to get something here. I just love being here. And I love being with you. So sometimes I want to I have an understanding of what state I'm in, so to speak, you know. And I don't relate to, when you talk about your experience, the experience of a yoni, then I identify with that, and I, from experiential viewpoint, I know what you're talking about. Then when you start, at some point in your talks, you come to a point of talking about, well, you know, you think about this, or you talking about people who aren't yonis, you know, that if you've suffered, if you're out of sorts, you're this and that, and you start talking on another level, and for me, it's either I don't relate to it, it's not my experience, or I laugh because it's so funny that those words would even be said. And so at this point, I want to get some kind of a sense of something.
Let me explain. When I answer your question, take it for what it's worth. I do everything spontaneously, and I have no preconceived ideas about it. So I talk and answer the way it's supposed to be at this time.
But if it's worth nothing, then take it for what it's worth means what?
Take it for what it's worth means...
It's inaccurate.
It's not inaccurate. That's the answer you need at this time. Whether you know it or
not. To just listen to.
To just listen to.
And reflect.
Whether you know it or not.
And reflect the problem.
I don't
believe that.
Okay.
At all. And I don't accept it either, because I've seen too many too many things that seem to be amiss in that direction. I mean, there's a side of it that I see that's perfect about it. You know, it depends what while you're doing something spontaneously, what the reaction is for people. And it's quite good. But it's not always. It doesn't seem... I don't know. It's, for me, it's not appropriate.
That's what you should say.
It doesn't, yeah.
That's your opinion. That's how you see it.
It doesn't do... sometimes it doesn't feel appropriate, so... It's almost like I didn't even need to ask you, yet I wanted to ask you, and maybe that's why your response is appropriate. Is you give me something to reflect on is why you asking in the first place.
What you're actually saying is you don't like abstract answers.
No, I love.
You want a direct answer.
Yeah. To me, to the person who's asking. Yeah, it would be good.
You're saying sometimes you hit the nail on the head, and sometimes you miss.
Yeah.
Says who?
Individually.
That's what he's saying.
That's self's opinion.
Yeah.
That's a self's opinion.
See, what can I say?
Uh-huh.
I'm the way I am.
Yeah.
I walk in here and I just say what comes naturally.
Yeah. Well, I wonder why I experience a difference in my communication with you when I'm privately with you versus when I'm with you when other people are around. I notice a definite difference.
There's something in you that enjoys the privacy more. You probably want to be closer to me.
But so the response I get from you is very different.
Well, maybe because I pick up certain things in you particularly at the time. Because it's a different time and a different place.
But those are corresponding exactly to when I'm alone with you or when I'm...
See, a person's psyche changes daily. Now we're talking about psychology. We're going back into the relative world. A person's psyche changes daily. It's never the same. So perhaps when I don't know, but perhaps when I talk to you privately on a certain day, I pick up something in you that's different than this today. So I answer you differently. But what I answered you today is what I did spontaneously that came out.
Well, I've had an experience where I talked with you in one day publicly and afterwards talked with you privately and found out that whatever the response was publicly was obviously a misunderstanding. And when I talked to you about it privately after satsang, right after, you know, only within half hour maybe when I asked you originally in public, there seems to be miscommunication, misunderstanding.
Things change, perhaps.
Yeah.
Things are changing every moment, moment to moment.
Robert, don't you also key your response not only to the individual...
Oh, I didn't know you were here, Dana. I didn't see you.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Don't you key your response to the individual who's asked the question as well as the general audience?
Yes, in a way.
So that might...
To tell you the truth, I don't even know what I do.
That takes care of it.
I'm just here. I really don't plan to cater to a general audience or to an individual. I just do what I do. If you like it, enjoy it. Keep it. If you don't, don't.
You don't have an explanation for your own actions?
No.
Your own
no, I don't.
Responses. Mm. They just occur.
They just occur.
Maybe a madman, we don't even know.
And
I probably am.
And there's no point really in trying to analyze them. It's
that's really the worst thing you can do.
Yeah, that's pointless.
If your answers to him are essentially so divergent, I mean, they're similar.
Perhaps that's what he means.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's actually...
No, I experience miscommunication whenever I talk or present something to Robert publicly.
Look at it this way. Everything is an awakening process.
Yeah.
Just take that.
Yeah. But, you know, on the other side, if one is in relationship with a teacher or someone, then sometimes one maybe not needs it, but want some kind of feedback as to what they've experienced, what they continue to experience, and how inappropriate the teacher is talking to the group, and it's not fitting every individual in the group.
Well, if I recall, I've given you many pertinent answers to personal questions.
Yeah, sure.
But now you ask a different kind of question, so you get this kind of an answer.
Yeah.
Just enjoy.
I do, of course I do, but...
Get your personality out of it.
Yeah.
Get rid of the personal I. And just be. All is well.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Now what was I talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Robert.
Mm-hmm.
Magazine. That article in Sai Baba.
Yes.
That's what we were talking about.
Oh, the article in Sai Baba. We finished that. It's a good article. Surely Sai Baba was an interesting guy. Somebody in India told me the story about him. He used to walk around naked. And at other times, he would dress like a king. And people would think he's from royalty. But when some pundits and Brahmins would seek him out to test him, he would take all his clothes off and stay naked before them and urinate in them. Then he'd run into the woods. I don't know what that means. I don't even know why I'm telling you this.
I hope you don't do that to us.
Yeah, right.
I think
bring your raincoat.
He is
so much for front row seats.
Really,
I'm bringing an umbrella next time I come here.
I'm moving to the back.
It's a new therapy.
Maybe that's what you're doing to us verbally sometimes.
What's your opinion?
No, it's your opinion. What was the point of that?
Humility.
That's because we were talking about it on the way here, remember?
I mean, it seems rude at the very least.
Accept any way you like.
What?
Accept it any way you like. You're free to do that.
You know, Robert, I heard a similar story of that one time that Yogananda told, that Kailangaswami used to do that. He would walk around naked and people thought he was deranged. And he would urinate on them so the police would arrest him, but the people found out later that it was fragrant and that he had infused a subtle blessing upon that.
Isn't it like to blow their minds, you know?
Yes.
Blow their minds so that it shocked them from what they'd expected.
Yes, of course.
The old Zen masters were full of things like
that.
Yes, of course. It was a matter of color. Outrageous stuff. Absolutely outrageous.
That's Lyndon Johnson quality rudeness, really.
Not that
bad. Yeah, but if it helps you to awaken, great.
Yeah.
It shocks you awake.
You're trying to
use
the shock
showers. Blessed
sheep. It's all for the good. If your mind becomes ruffled and you feel something is wrong, ask yourself, to whom does this come? That attitude must be gotten rid of. You shouldn't really have any type of attitude whatsoever. It's Greek to me.
Yeah, it is Sanskrit, and it's just a prayer to the divine. And basically, most of the words mean God.
Jaya, sort of hail to
the chief.
Hail to the chief.
Since most of us are English-speaking folks, if this is a teaching from a culture who knows these words, I assume it is, and they know what this means, and this is meaningful to them, would it not be more meaningful to us to speak in English and say blessed?
Not really.
It wouldn't rhyme.
I'll tell you.
That would kill it right there.
It doesn't sound exotic either.
I'll tell you why. Sanskrit. It's one of the few languages that are left on this earth where every word is another word for God. It's a very meaningful language in that respect. Whereas the English language,
it loses a lot in the translation too. Like if you take a Wagnerian opera, it sounds beautiful in German, but when you hear it in English, he's talking, my finger, I hurt my finger. It's so stupid. But it's when you don't understand what the words are, it seems so profound.
That's
just for your information, Judith Tyberg has a beautiful booklet out on Sanskrit. It's a primer called Language of the Gods. It's available down at the Bodhi Tree. We used to work with East West, and we mailed out tons of them every day to different people all over the world. So,
what are the books?
Sanskrit.
It's nice, easy to read.
Little book that's like a primer, you know, Dick and Jane went together.
Chase the Yanni.
It's easy to read.
Primers are us.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are beautiful words.
But we do a lot of beauty.
Enjoy.
wouldn't it mean more to us mortals?
Okay, let's play some.
Does it bring that feeling through us? Is that what it's meant to do? Is to bring that feeling?
Let's play some English words.
There's another point to Sanskrit. Someone did some testing on the Sanskrit language, and they found that the people who chanted Om the way it was supposed to be chanted, and it was connected to a polygraph or some kind of graph system, it came out and spelled actually through the sound vibration how you spell it in Sanskrit.
So what?
So So that means the power of the vibration of the...
Let's sing English.
But if you said something in words...
Sing, Clyde.
I'm sure it really doesn't matter, but isn't it customary in bhajans for the person who starts the song to sing a verse and then the remainder of people respond?
Yes.
And then each time he says it alone and then the response?
Right. Yes.
We're doing good.
You're not the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, but you'll be okay. The question always arises, is Advaita Vedanta a practical teaching? It may be good for Indians, or people who live in caves, or monks. But is it practical? You know it is, because it teaches you that you are not the body and you are not the mind, but your body came to this earth to do something, and it's going to do that what it came to do, whether you like it or not. This means you are in the right place, but you lose identification with the doer or with the body. You know that you are not the doer. Therefore, if you're a banker, you become a better banker. If you're a garbage collector, you become a better garbage collector. If you're a postman, you become a better postman. And if you're nothing, you become a better good for nothing. So the teaching is very practical. It removes worry. It removes fear. It removes anxiety. It makes you understand that you are life itself and all is well. There's nothing wrong. There are no mistakes. Everything is unfolding as it should. And everything is beautiful, just the way it is. Right now. Now I know you can tell me, but Robert, what about this? What about that? The reason you bring this up is because you're thinking. But when I said everything is beautiful right now, this moment, you cannot deny that. Right this second, is there anything wrong? As soon as you start to think there is, but in the second there's bliss. If you can expand that second, you will be self-realized. Stay in the second. There's nothing happening. And you taste the bliss. You feel the Satchitananda. But as soon as your mind begins, it's lost. That's why I emphasize, kill the mind. Still the mind, annihilate the mind. Become no mind whatsoever. And you will always live in the second.
When we do the self-inquiry and we ask, who am I, that silence is also
yes.
When you don't respond.
The silence without thought is the second I'm referring to. But whenever there's thought, no matter what kind of thought, even good thoughts, you spoil it. Remember, we're not trying to exchange bad thoughts for good thoughts. We want to stop thoughts and merge with the infinite. Again, this does not mean you will be spaced out. It means if you're an artist, you will become more creative. And your body will do the work. But you will be totally free. You will not think, I hope somebody likes my art. I hope I'm good. I hope I win an award. I'll be devastated if I'm bad. Those thoughts will be gone from your life. You will have no goals. Your body will just do whatever it has to do. But you will not identify with the body. Any questions about that?
Robert, so is a feeling, does being have a feeling? Is that love, bliss?
No, being has no feeling, because there has to be somebody present to feel.
But what's the bliss? Isn't bliss a feeling?
Bliss is an experience. It is just being, not being this or being that. It is being, and it is ineffable.
Is it similar to feeling? It's a good...
No, it's not a good feeling.
Bliss, the word bliss.
Good feelings lead to bad feelings.
Well, it's not a feeling, but it's a ecstatic kind of...
No, it's not ecstatic.
What about the ecstasies of the different sages? They're supposed to be in tremendous ecstasy.
Those are yogis going through their samadhis.
Oh, really? So ecstasy is only a point that has to be given up at a point.
The bliss we're talking about is beyond ecstasy.
Who experiences bliss?
No one. Bliss just is. There's no one left to experience it.
There's bliss, period, full stop. Mm-hmm. That's it.
That's it.
What about the self?
The self is the same as bliss.
But doesn't the word bliss seem to bring to mind a happiness, an infinite happiness?
To whom's mind?
Well, then you can't use the word bliss, because bliss connotates some kind of an infinite happiness. So.
To whom does it connote that to? That's your experience. But if you listen to what I say, bliss is beyond humanhood, beyond concepts, beyond feelings.
Yes. Beyond feelings.
Bliss just is. It's isness. And you cannot describe it. You cannot explain it.
But you can be it. Or being is it.
You are it.
You are.
And when you become silent, you experience it. But you can never explain it. That's what the word power Brahman means. Beyond Brahman.
But the mind doesn't, like my mind doesn't want to accept that there's anything in the silence. You know, it sees the silence for a moment and right away it says, oh, there's nothing in here. So run to thoughts, run to experience, run to knowledge.
So sing bhajans.
That's what singing or listening to music throws the mind out again. Mm. And I get rid of the mind.
Chant.
Like, it's like the consciousness knows there's something in the silence, something of infinite value, but the mind keeps saying there's nothing in this. You know?
Consciousness does not know that. You're speaking of your personal ego. Your ego knows that, but consciousness
isn't
is self-contained.
But doesn't consciousness egg us on? Isn't there something egging us on to transcend the ego?
They say that in some books, but it's not my experience. My experience is there's nothing to egg you on. If something existed, you would never be consciousness. Everything has to be transcended. There can't be one iota of any human thought left.
But then the nothingness is influencing to some extent, to throw us into the nothingness.
The only thing that's influencing you is that you are already in your real state. So the reality of your real state wants you to come back to it.
So that's pushing us.
But that's still on the relative plane.
It's pushing us because it already is.
The reality has a want?
No.
He says it wants you to come back to it.
That's why it says on the relative plane.
Oh.
That appears that way in the relative plane. But the truth is, there's nothing left. There's nobody to want. How can you want something that you are?
It's like the eye trying to see itself.
Yes. And you can never get it physically, verbally, or mentally. You have to go beyond that.
This is not going to be a popular teaching.
That's good.
It's not good for business.
That's right.
Robert, maybe you could find together a couple things that you don't totally sit there in my mind about. The self-inquiry, the clinging to the eye, is correct. I think that's sort of a process of going inward.
And the self-inquiry what?
Seems like the self-inquiry is sort of like a process of going inward. The focus is
yes.
Inward.
Yes.
There are some things that occur to us in life where maybe driving cars and so forth where you can devote your full time to that. So if I can't, because it's inappropriate.
When you're driving a car?
Yeah, sometimes. Traffic. And so from that point of view, mindfulness, it seems like a good thing to practice. Which seems like it's going in the outer direction, but on the other hand, the whole business helps to quiet the mind to the extent that you're in mindfulness, perhaps.
Well, that's okay, but self-inquiry is not meditation. So you can practice it while you're driving your car.
Well, there are times when I don't, it feels like I would risk my life if I'm in some situation driving, if I were to run. I do sometimes, but if I'm in a...
Well, what are you saying to yourself? What are you doing?
Nothing if I'm in one of those situations. I'm just reverting to whatever I think I need to do to drive. I'm in a tight situation on the freeway or something.
You can look at the cars and you can say, to whom do these cars come from? Who am I that thinks about the crowds of cars? Who's the eye that observes this?
Yeah.
You can do that while you're driving.
Okay, so it's all, in other words, there is theoretically you can, the practice can extend through all.
Through all of life.
All of life.
And everything.
And if you don't feel so disposed, you don't have to revert to, quote, mindfulness.
No, you don't. But you can if you want to.
Right.
Well, that, isn't that what you were talking about, observing ourselves at all times? So you might say, to whom does this frustration with the traffic come?
Yes, yes.
So you probably still react as a person that then you inquire about.
And it's safe to drive your car while you're doing it. You will not go into a trance.
Robert, what is meditation?
Meditation is focusing on an object.
So if in life you're doing something like pouring water, you can say, is it appropriate to say, who is pouring water? And then in blatant contrast to all the karmic yogi teachings, you say, I am pouring water, and then just pursue the clear mind.
You can say that. You can say, who is pouring water? Then you can say, I am. Then I am pouring water.
You say what?
Just I am. And then you ask, who am I? Because when you say, I am pouring water, you'll go right back to your ego. Just say, I am. Okay, Colin. Take care of yourself. See you again.
Rob, what is the mind?
Nothing. It's a conglomeration of thoughts.
This is what occurred to me. I don't know if I haven't thought it out, but when you told us before that you have thought that they're spontaneous, and it seems like that may also be a product of the mind, and that seems that that's a proper function, that say those that have other attitudes that are mental, fear, anger, any of the other sort of, if those are, I don't know if those are necessarily a product of the mind or a product of conditioning or whatever. And yet they may both function in the mind. They both respond in these other things.
Well, they don't function in the mind because they are the mind themselves. They make up the mind. In other words, you're telling me that the mind is like a receptacle and has all of these thoughts. But it's not a receptacle at all. The mind is the thoughts themselves. So when you think a thought, it comes from a preconceived idea. It comes from your being programmed. All thoughts are from the past and the future. There are no original thoughts. So every one of us has been programmed since we were little and from past lives. And that's what's in the mind right now. That's what the mind is made up of. So you have to ask yourself, to whom does this mind come? And if you follow it through, you will realize there never was a mind. Because the mind is only thoughts. It's nothing solid, nothing tangible. It's a bunch of thoughts.
But how about those thoughts that could may come to you that are spontaneously generated?
That's so that I exist in the moment.
Are those also of mind thoughts? Or?
Those are just thoughts. It's like the mind has been extinguished, but there's still a little bit left to keep you going on the earth. That's how it appears to others. But in reality, there's no mind.
No thoughts, no mind.
No thoughts, no mind.
Is the mind the thing that operates also when someone's doing something? Say they're involved in a work, a chore, a task, a problem, or something like that.
If they are not enlightened, the mind controls you. The mind is your master. It tells you all the things that you think about all day long. Mm-hmm. And it makes you into the doer. So you take appropriate action. When the mind is extinguished, there's no one to take any action. But you become spontaneous, or you wouldn't be here at all. You would just disappear. As long as I'm here as you see me the way I am, there has to be a mind, a little bit of a mind left, to play the game with you that I'm playing. But it's all spontaneous. And that's how it's explained, but in reality it doesn't exist.
Does meditation always imply a dualism? There has to be a focus on
an object.
Well, there has to be someone focused on it.
Yes, there has to be a subject and an object.
So that's always dualistic.
That's always dualistic.
Yeah. It never transcends.
No.
Meditation cannot transcend.
It cannot. It can lead you to a place where you become quiet and then you drop the meditation.
Well, it's like the thorn, then. It's a means to an end.
It's a means to an end.
Abidance in the self might be called meditation also.
No, because abidance in the self is thinking of I am. There is no form, no shape.
Yeah, but I mean, loosely, some people may say, well, I meditate when they abide in the self.
They may say that. Let them.
But it's a misnomer.
It's a misnomer, yes.
Because there's no dualism.
It's only one.
And just one of that cancels meditation.
Robert, you said
meditation as we're defining it right
as
here.
As we're defining it.
Robert, you said abiding in the self is thinking of I am. But isn't it just being I am? It's not thinking of
it. It turns into being. Okay. In the beginning, you think about I am, then it turns into pure being. You use the mind to destroy the mind.
Hmm. Seems like the mind's only here to protect the body, right? Keep it going.
Well, actually, the body came first. Because you think you're a body, you think you're a mind. So you can think of the body.
Without the body, there wouldn't be a mind. The mind seems to come up. So the eye is the body.
The eye is the body.
Without the body, there wouldn't be the mind, and without the mind, there wouldn't be the eye.
And there wouldn't be any thoughts.
So the eye is the body. The ego eye is the
body.
The knee is the body.
Robert, you can have a mind as long as the quality of the thoughts entertained no longer participate in the illusion of the identification with the body.
Then you wouldn't have a mind.
Well, no, you would have thoughts, but they wouldn't have the quality of maya. They would be just functional thoughts.
That's what we're talking about, spontaneity. They would be spontaneous, yes, that's right. True.
It's like impersonal thoughts. It's like a computer just to do the job. Like
yes.
The working mind, the functional mind.
So it's not the mind that's transformed. Maya is filtered out of the thoughts so that we no longer believe in the illusion. Or the thoughts don't dwell on the illusion that this is this, there's a separation, that's this over there, that's a car, that's a tree.
Those thoughts disappear completely. There's only enough thought left so you can't exist. But again, that's an appearance.
Robert, following your last question, then in general, would it be appropriate to don't use any adjuncts, like, for example, you say, if I would say, who's thinking? The I am. And then go into who am I?
That's it. But when some experience comes to you, you ask yourself, to whom does this experience come?
Well, it seems like you could do one or the other. I mean, you could do that with thoughts too, could you not?
Sure you can.
So is there a preference, like, to whom do these thoughts come, or who is
it? Yes, exactly.
There is a preference, what is it?
There's no preference. You do what you have to do at the time.
But there is a preference not to stick adjuncts on I am, because that will drag you back into the ego.
That's true after a while. In the beginning you do. You ask, to whom does this come? Who's feeling this pain? Who has this pain? To whom does it come?
Yeah.
Then you say, to me. Who's me? Who am I?
And if you skip the I am part, what did you say? Who's having this experience? Who's feeling the pain? What if you, is it appropriate to say, I am, or I am feeling the pain in the beginning?
Yes. I am. And think for a while and say, who is this I am? Where did it come from?
So when you say that I am, you're saying it's better, even from the beginning, just to say I am and don't say I am feeling the pain?
You have to be so spontaneous. It depends what you're going through. I know what you're driving at. I don't want to give you an exact practice,
okay. Right.
Because the practice is different to all people.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. It'll all come to you when you do it.
May I ask a dumb question?
Go ahead. Who spoke?
Me.
Oh.
You have to have a body before the mind. When does the mind enter the body? In utero? or after utero?
The mind enters the body when you believe you are the body.
No, no. Oh, you're talking in a more esoteric sense than I was. Because you say the body, you have to have a body to be a vehicle for the mind.
Yes.
So the body is a container.
Yes.
The mind developed in what progressed to be more clinical. At what time is this, when the child is being carried, or
I see what you mean.
Or when it emerges from the mother, or just when does it become this thinking, sentient person capable in childhood or development?
About 40.
Yeah, that's a good answer. They'll say that we're really not capable of thinking until 12, or I mean, of being analytical in child development until 12 or 13, or different things.
When you're approximately 7 months in the womb, the body consciousness starts to function.
So how about what we call the soul principle, which is also... Now, how would you take the soul component apart different from this mind or this mental energy? Where does that come from, and when does it end?
The soul and the mind are the same. Yes.
So now you have just said that the mind is thoughts, which are like abstract thoughts that are just whatever. Now we can't, we would almost be insulting to say that the soul is a bunch of just abstract.
This is true, the soul does not exist. There is no soul.
There's no soul.
No.
Then a lot of people are very disillusioned, are they not?
I should think so.
So what do we call this? A group soul or a group energy?
There's no group energy, there's no group soul.
So what differentiates you, Robert, from Harley or this lady or whatever? How do we become separated and just not being a great big glue? There has to be some kind of separation for us to have a separateness to communicate with.
The separation appears because you believe you are the body.
You believe you're the own body? No.
When you believe you are the body, that's separate. Then there are other bodies. There's this body, there's that body. There are millions of bodies. Because you believe that you are a body. When that belief vanishes, then there's no body. There's only consciousness.
In other words, you would just drop the body?
No. The body never was to begin with. The body never existed. There's nothing to drop. You just become free.
Now, are you saying that the body is like what we're talking about? Dichotomy is a philosophy or whatever. Is this a matter of semantics? We're back to the young man asking the question here. There are, you have on a blue shirt which separates your body from Sheila back here, who has on a red jacket. But if you're in pure consciousness or in a state of total awareness, then you would be one with your brother. In that philosophical, like a philosophical conundrum or whatever, which becomes almost a double talk here. Are you speaking at that if you reach a pure state of consciousness, then you become so totally one that you feel a presence with everything and everyone, which is often the supposed attained goal, to become so free of your own personal thoughts that you can blend with the whole?
You compare the screen and the images. When you're totally free, you're like the screen. But you know the images are on you.
And we're just players, like Shakespeare would say?
We're all players. So every human form, every sentient being, every tree, every animal, every cloud, every particle of dust is a superimposition on consciousness.
Now, if consciousness is the real, genuine thing, and we are only reflections of this consciousness, then the consciousness, how do I ask this in mundane questions? This has to be something very not material, but...